Welcome to Savage Starlight, the officially unofficial podcast for The Last of Us on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 1, Episode 2. It's titled Infected. Aaron, we've seen this a couple of times now. How do you feel?
It's a great episode. I have heard through the grapevine from people who have seen it that the general sentiment is, like, if you think these first two episodes are good, wait until you get to episode 3. But, like, these are really okay. Good episodes. So I guess I'm really ready to be blown the fuck away by next week. But this is a great episode. All of the things that I was hoping would happen in terms of they'd capture the tension of, you know, the action elements of this game, the scariness of the monsters, the zombies, the tense, quiet moments, the character beats, the loss, all that stuff. And what I, you know, I'm also on top of that getting, you know, like backstory that we don't even get in the game, which I think, mm-hmm. you know, I know you had some mixed feelings about it, but I really appreciate. And I just can't get over how gorgeous the visuals are, how. You know, I was thinking they would get kind of close or whatever, but so far when they're walking around these bombed out, like, you know, Boston's city centers, they just look utterly real and convincing. They literally look like things out of the video game, which already looked fairly lifelike, you know, in the terms of the tech. I can only think of the remastered versions, but they're just, like, utterly convincing and real. And, I love sometimes the contrast between, like, what a beautiful day it is when they're walking through downtown Boston versus, like, how mm-hmm. scary the interiors are. And it's good stuff. And you know, like, there was a lot of grousing about the spore versus tendril. A lot of people had wrong-headed ideas about what the tendrils would actually represent. And I feel like all that stuff is shut up since this, you know, because they, boom, this is
yeah, they paid it off.
It's a great mechanic. It's arguably, like, Neil was talking on the podcast that, like, kind of kicking themselves, like, why didn't we think of, like, these tripwire aspects? That's just a terrific game element, let alone a dramatic element. So mm-hmm. it's distinct from the game, but also very fungal based and uniquely terrifying on its own. So I thought this is just a great episode, and I even more relaxed to just enjoy the ride. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, the word that describes this episode is tense to me. I think, like, every moment of it is building toward the end, you know, where Joel triggers the fungal network and here come the horde. And it's down to not just, like, the setup of the writing and the plot, but also the cinematography. I couldn't help but, like, in those scenes where they've set this up as a concept and then they close up on Joel's boots as he's walking across the ground. I felt like in a war movie where, like, there are soldiers out in the jungle and they're tromping through this undergrowth, and you know that there are mortar trip mines or claymore trip mines out there just waiting to blow them up. And I'm so tensed up even just watching a man walk across pavement, right? It's like, yeah, at any moment this could go wrong, and they do it beautifully with just a couple of insert shots, close-ups, and I felt like that the entire episode. And even in the scenes where, like, some of the tension is actively paying off, like that clicker scene, it somehow is even more tense because they take their time with those scenes. They don't have this isn't a show that's gonna, you know, jump scare you out of your seat. Mm-hmm. But it is going to make you feel extremely unsettled while you're watching the things it's showing you. So I very much appreciate that. That's kind of horror that I like.
Yeah, they in the little mini-sodes that they have, like the making of, Craig Mazin said that Neil Druckmann, because he directed this. You know, we talked about this in Instant Cast, how, you know, Neil mentioned several times that this is very, very like directing video games with some notable limitations. But Craig Mazin called him the master of fear. And I was thinking about that. It's like,
because the master of horror is already taken.
Who is the master of horror? Is that Clive Barker or is it Stephen King? Because I've heard someone called the master of horror. Maybe it's a lot of different people.
I can't remember who they call that.
So John Carpenter?
I've heard it. Maybe. Maybe.
But then I was reflecting my time because, like, you know, there's lots of games that have horrific things like Doom, you know, especially the remakes that are not scary. But like The Last of Us is very scary to play. It's a very tense game. It's still like, you know, I mentioned that like anytime there is an infected on my ass, because they're so lethal, they're so fast, they're so tough that like it's not unusual for me to be screaming and shrieking and like moving around on the couch and feeling like they're just right behind me. And this episode captured all that. And
every time, you know, I walk into a darkened room or building, right, I feel that tension in the game, and this captured that too.
Yeah, and that point, you're, I don't know if you heard the official podcast, but you were completely vindicated in your thoughts about Tess being kind of like partially frozen by the fungus. The fungus, you know, recognizing her as a part of it, and this deliberate infection and things. Even that is just, you know, this is stuff that's not in the game. In fact, they made pretty big changes in the way this episode goes down from how it goes down in the game. But like that kiss is just so uncomfortable. It's so hard. The second, third time watching, I'm still just like, it's terrible in the best way.
And it ties in with some of the other themes they've been setting up, where they, you know, Ellie's asking Joel this episode, do you ever think about like the people they were, or someone who maybe is still inside there? And with Tess, that's actively happening. I mean, look at her hand. What's she doing? She's trying to kill these things as she's being taken over by them. She is the example. She is the test case there that shows, there are people inside these things.
And there's so many subtle things they did that, you know, they talk about like Tess being infected, but almost with hope, because like being bitten, notice she was in certainty. She only has minutes to live.
Yeah.
Suddenly broadens her horizon to like, well, if I'm going to die, I want this to mean something. I want this to where, you know, this never happens to somebody else. I want to live. I want to, you know, contribute to a world to where we can go back to living, you know, without fear. It's powerful stuff.
In direct contrast with Joel, right? Who he lives at, he pretends like he knows everyone is going to die, right? He's telling Tess, like, why are you trying to act like this girl is going to have a life? Mm-hmm. It's but yet he still continues to try and live, right? So there's like a strange hope that he's denying within himself until, you know, they're looking out from the darkness and seeing the light. So I don't know. There are a couple of shots in here that really express that well.
There is definitely, they definitely using that as a shorthand for kind of like philosophical sides and who's in the light, who's in the darkness, who's transitioning from the darkness into the light. And
that's
it's
good.
Like
filmmaking.
It's like, you know, sometimes I've seen shows where they do that well, but they all the other stuff and it feels like, you know, very film student-y. It's like, oh, you're doing the visual metaphor. But like here, we're just, you don't even have to notice it because everything, all the cake is there. The icing in the decoration just takes it to the next level. Like that constant thematic. And it just goes like, I was just amazed listening to the official podcast where like the metaphors and, you know, like that, Craig Mazin mentioned that like the way they see it, the fungus loves to, you know, like the fungus recognizes itself. The fungus wants to spread, like the fungus loves things. And when you love, you know, you get people together and you love, you make more of yourself. And it's like, I mean, I think this is like not a literal anthropomorphization of it, but the fact that they're thinking of things like that and how, you know, intimate that, you know, as horrifying as it was, very intimate, the way that the cordyceps took over Tess ultimately. It's great stuff. And again, it's not stuff that you have to notice, but I think stuff like that works on a subconscious level, even if it's not working in any other.
Well, it is. It's paying off. I mean, have you seen the viewership ratings for the second episode? It's up, 22%, I think. 5.7 million people now, up from like 4 point something last time. This is how
so
you
far,
do it.
I mean, very successful in spreading its own infection. Yeah,
absolutely. Those spores and tendrils are going out. People are being infected by them. This is how you do it, right? I mean, at this point, if this were released on Netflix, they'd be contemplating canceling it because not enough people had completed the series yet. 4 days
maybe,
after it's released or whatever.
Yeah.
HBO, you know, they're building multi-season mega hits, and I feel like Netflix, you know, is building cancel fodder essentially. This is how you do it. You get people hyped, you get people talking, and then you give them 9 weeks to sit with this thing and really appreciate and enjoy it.
Yeah, for that to spread, to run its course. And, you know, it's like we mentioned this in contrast to House of Dragons. Like, oh, this is about half the audience. That's still a huge hit for HBO. Mm-hmm. What House of the Dragon did is held its audience week over week with very modest gains. Just, you know, a couple 50,000, 100,000 here. But, like, you pretty much had 10 million people watch the beginning, 10 million people. And that's unusual. Usually the pattern is you always get the most people watching at the finales, and then you have a slow amount of drop off until you get to the, or I mean, you get a lot of people, your most biggest audience at the premiere kind of tails off. So just to hold that audience constant is pretty impressive. But the build, that just shows that the word of mouth, and there've been some really out of the box marketing stuff. Have you seen some of, like, there's some European cities where they've taken a whole block over and they have a big, like, skyscraper size, not, you know, like, you know, Times New Roman Times Square size billboard. Come on, there's no fungus in here. What the hell's going on? The Times New Roman Times Square size billboard with the whole square taken over with, like, decay. They made the buildings
dressed
look decayed,
like Boston,
and with fungus and all that stuff. And, like, even if you have never heard of this, like, if you're just walking around this downtown area, you're like, what the fuck is this? I gotta check this out.
And they're doing, like, graffiti exhibits and art installations where there's, you know, people plastered to the wall with fungus exploding out of them. It's,
yeah,
I have to wonder what people who don't know anything about The Last of Us think when they see one of those.
It's gotta. And when you got a product like that, those looky-loos you get a lot of times are going to convert the fans because the product is there. It's like, Jesus, you go up to a bus stop and there's, like, some fungal dude walled to it. And then on the reverse side, it's got Firefly graffiti and The Last of Us, HBO, blah, 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 Sundays at 9. Fuck, I want to tune into that. Oh, my God, this is good. I'm going to start. Yeah, it's. Yeah,
and
you get 22%
no
week over week growth. And, like, where will that top out? Because if the next episode is really. And once you get out of football season where, like, people Sundays, Sunday nights are going to be a little bit more freed up, man, the back half of the season could be really big. I wonder if it, do you think it's crazy to think that it might catch up to House of the Dragon? Or do you think this 22% is unsustainable?
It could. What I'm hoping is that House of the Dragon, you know, given how solid that was, gets really good word of mouth in the off season and grows again. So maybe I'm hoping that House of Dragon will outpace it because I also love that show.
And it has a much larger existing fan base. Like,
it does, yeah.
Although,
so, I don't know. We'll see.
How many copies did The Last of Us sell?
Millions. Certainly millions.
Yeah.
And it's been re-released a few times, so more millions.
Yeah, I wonder. I know that Last of Us 2 is like 37 million copies. So, like, I think at the height of Game of Thrones, like season 7, season 8, it was said that 100 million people worldwide were watching. That's 37 million is a big audience base for this show. So if you've got, you know, half of these people just out of curiosity want to see, and, like, if you're a fan of the game, why the hell wouldn't you like this show? It's got a lot of upside, a lot of legs. HBO must be pleased and probably also screaming internally that this is such a short-lived thing. They're like, Druckmann, you got a third game. They're going to hold him up by his ankles until they shake the candy out because you got a third game in you. I know you fucking do.
Yeah, not in 2 years they don't. Sorry. It takes longer than that to make those games.
Yeah.
What do you say we get into the recap?
Let's do it. Watch out for that fungus. Be right back with more Savage Starlight.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and we'll find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We found something to fight for. This podcast. Welcome back to Savage Starlight. All right, we start off in Jakarta, September 24th, 2003. This is 2 days before Joel's birthday that we saw in the first episode. A mycologist is pulled from a restaurant by the military to examine a corpse with a fungal infection. When she realizes the scope of the problem, she tells them to bomb the entire city.
Yeah, so you were kind of lukewarm on this stuff. Do you see the point in it anymore? Is it still kind of like the calm before the storm?
I have not come to terms with this scene yet. I still think it's relatively useless. Unless they're going to do more flashbacks, I guess. I am kind of curious to see what they think they're going to accomplish with bombing these cities and what actually is accomplished by bombing these cities. Because Tess in this episode says, yeah, they bombed in a lot of cities. It actually worked in Boston, at least well enough for them to establish a QZ there. So I don't, I am curious about seeing that. So if this leads to more scenes of the bombings and stuff, sure.
To me, this is a good... First of all, I think it's just inherently frightening when you see a true expert just give up. Like when they see it, they're like, you know, like there's something very chilling. It's like one thing if you're, you know, you say you got a lump in your neck and your nervous Aunt Nellie or Uncle Gary is this, you know, the one that's always freaking out about stuff is like, oh my God, do you think it's cancer? And it's like, okay, whatever. But you go into an oncologist and they come over somber faced and like, you know, I hate giving people bad news. Like you sit up and pay attention. Like this is a foremost fungal expert. Mm-hmm. And when she finds out that there are already 14 workers missing for 30 hours in this massive city and they do a great job in what is suspiciously stock footage looking footage for Jakarta, you know, you see how packed this city is and how like densely populated. Mm-hmm. And as soon as she finds out, you see her hands like violently shake. She can barely get the tea down. I just thought that was really, really effective. The fact that she just like you should just wipe the city off the map. and then realizing the implications aren't worth, like, can I go home to my family? Because I'm, you know, if you either aren't going to follow my advice, in which case we're fucked, mm-hmm. or you are going to follow my advice, in which case we're at least locally going to be fucked. And the other thing is just if you put together the information from the first episode, this happens on September 24th. The stuff that happens in Austin, Texas was September 26th. Mm-hmm. In 48 hours, you are going to go from Jakarta being a normal city to, like, you hear this widespread unrest, and it's going to spread throughout, you know, all the way to North America. So it just gives you an idea of, like, really how fast this was able to take hold. And there's all kinds of meta questions, like, why did the Indonesian government, like, apparently try to keep this like an internal matter, but also, like, would your host country blather to the world that you have a major outbreak that's going to, you know, it's like, I don't know. I just thought this stuff is chilling, and maybe I still have a little bit lower tolerance for fear, but every time she went in that in the room with the corpse and she's cutting on it, I kept expecting that lady to just pop off the table and start chewing on her. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. I felt personal, and, you know, personal disgust when she pulls that fungus out of her mouth and starts, you know, trying to go at her. So that stuff, it really worked on me.
Gotcha. Yeah, I guess to me it felt like a little unnecessary. When you see, okay, the world has been overtaken, you have to assume this happened very fast, right? You hear the news reports, well, this is like a day after, or two days after the events in Jakarta, you know, kind of like, okay, this is spreading exceptionally fast. I don't know. It's not a bad scene. Like, these are all really good scenes. It's just, did I need to see them?
I want to, before we move on to the next scene, I want to talk about the intro credits. It looks like they're kind of a bust in terms of rewatchability. Yeah. A lot of people are like, oh, what if that fungal map actually updates? And I guess we haven't gotten out of Boston.
True.
But I watched it. I've watched it three times now, and I don't even see the hooks where you could move to a different city and the map would actually reflect something different. I think it's a... Mm-hmm. Anytime you got a traveling show that you're going around a lot of geographic area and you want to ground people in location and give them a scope of where you're going, I think maps are great. But yeah, this is just a really pretty fungal somber intro that I'm going to hit skip intro.
Well, it's still better than House of the Dragon's intro. So,
yeah. Well, at least House of the Dragon did kind of update and tell a bit of a narrative.
Did it? Because I couldn't tell what was happening in that at all.
Right. No,
it's
they did.
Blood-soaked castle.
New wheels popping up and new connections being made.
Oh, I know,
like, it's still bad. Yeah.
It's poorly done. All right, let's I guess talk about Ellie waking up to find Joel and Tess watching her. They're trying to figure out her infection status and what to do with her. Joel wants to take her back and let somebody else deal with her. Tess wants to continue on and get what they want, regardless of whether the hope of a cure is a pipe dream or not. And so they go outside, where Ellie gets her first view of the city in the daytime, and then they head toward the state house. She is duly impressed. And so was I, man. This looks amazing. This is one of those effect shots where I don't see the seams. I just see the world that they're creating.
Yeah, I'm amazed because this is all bright. You know, this is the worst environment to hide those seams, when everything's brightly lit with harsh overhead lighting and it's broad daylight. I will say that I could see the seams in one or two of these transits, especially later when they're going from the hotel to the, or going from the museum to the state capitol. There's one or two scenes where Tess and was, like, you know, jerking Ellie along in the foreground, and I could kind of see the scene where they had added the digital mat behind them or whatever, but, like, you have to look for it. You have to really look for it. And it
usually
doesn't,
it's a case of lighting being poor that really gives that away. I see a lot, even in, like, incredibly high budget things, you can see the lighting just doesn't quite match up. And I think of this in, like, Loki. Was a show where occasionally I would see, well, they lit this scene just slightly wrong. And I'm not, like, disparaging the people who did it, because that's an incredibly hard thing to do accurately. Mm-hmm. But when it's right, it just makes everything cohesive together in a way that feels like you're in a real world. And when it's wrong, it sticks out like a sore thumb.
Yeah. And I think they did a lot of things right. And the visuals, again, were just gorgeous. Like that... That opening shot of Ellie lying in a fetal position on this bed of moss, and it's lit like, you know, almost like she's like this brand new creation. Mm-hmm. This like, you know, that's being incubated. It's she's not a fungus. She's not human. She's like this just brand new life form. I thought that was really cool. And in fact, it was so out of place that I thought it was like something from a dream. But then they kind of shoot out and you see that this is just like nature has reclaimed this area from a collapsed piece of ceiling, and it gets sunlight and rain. And it's like a little tiny terrarium that she's sleeping in. And then the contrast, yeah, but how peaceful she was and how well she slept, to then this jingly jangly Joel and Tess, who would be smoking cigarettes if they had them, just like, you know, like just with their guns, just waiting for this girl to start twitching. It's a great contrast.
Yeah. There's something almost miraculous about it. Like Ellie is the miracle, and she's laying in this other miracle, which is like this indoor terrarium. Like you said, this is a great exercise, I guess, in contrast throughout this entire scene, mm-hmm. where you have these people who very much don't believe the thing she's telling them, or at least one of them certainly doesn't, and one of them is beginning to, and they contrast it with the food that they're eating and the lighting, obviously. I mean, that's the most stark, that's the most obvious example, and it comes back to, you know, when you're in the darkness, look to the light, that kind of thing, with the Firefly's motto.
It's hope versus hopelessness. It's you know, optimism versus cynicism. It's skepticism versus faith. There's a lot of, and yeah, a contrast between the cold, hard jerky of cynicism versus the sumptuous.
Oh, the sweet, sweet chicken, baby.
Oh, baby. Yeah, like some kind of Italian grinder, chicken grinder.
That's kind of what I was thinking. Is it like, it almost looked like she was eating a spaghetti sandwich for a second. I'm like, that can't be true. And then they say chicken, and I'm like, okay, all right.
Yeah, chicken parm sandwich some kind of, or something.
Yeah, chicken parm maybe. Boy, they're living right over there with the Fireflies.
Yeah.
I'm joining up if they're eating chicken sandwiches every day.
It's good to be a quasi-military smuggling operation in the post-apocalyptic environment.
Right, and that's another part of the contrast is just like, this is what hope can get you. This is what we're working toward. We could be building a civilization that can have everyone eating chicken sandwiches. Or you can continue to just have the same old give up attitude that you've had, and you can eat the stringy beef jerky. Take your pick, I guess.
Did you notice it? Because I think this is the scene where it's most noticeable when Joel forces open the door into the outside. Did you notice like the clicker noises it was making when those hinges were creaking and breaking? Yeah, there's a couple where I think that I thought it was a deliberate attempt to kind of foreshadow and put the people who have, you know, been veterans at a video game kind of on notice that you're heading into Clickerville. But I thought they were really well done and subtle.
Speaking of the video game, I couldn't really get a good look at the cover of that magazine that Ellie's supposed to use as toilet paper. Mm-hmm. I will say when she throws it back and forth, you get a look at the model that's like a big headshot just right there, a full page. Mm-hmm. It looks a lot to me like one of the heroines from Savage Starlight.
Does it?
I don't think it's supposed to be her, but man, it looks a lot like one of those covers, or at least one of the characters on one of those covers. So
yeah,
I
was going because
I
thought it looked like
reaching into the darkness trying to find something for Savage Starlight.
I 100% feel you on that one. I do think that it looked more like a fashion magazine to me. Uh-huh. And I was looking at some of these. Yeah. I was looking at some of the covers on the wiki, you know, because they've got all of mm-hmm. them. And I didn't see one that looked like it certainly didn't correspond to anything that you would find.
If you look at the cover with the guy and the woman, she's in like a white suit and they're kind of looking off away from each other a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It looks a lot like her.
Hmm. Yeah, I can see the you know, because it's essentially a attractive woman in like, what do you call that? A bob?
The haircut is definitely similar.
Mrs. Incredible type of outfit or kind of haircut. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just, and it looked, like I said, it looked like a, like an Elle magazine, like a fashion type of thing more than anything. And what's the phrase that they say? It's endure and survive.
Uh-huh.
I noticed that they're ending the official podcast with that phrase. I don't know if they did that last week and I didn't notice, but they're doing it. So like, I think that they have affection for the Savage Starlight. Yeah. It'd be awesome. It'd be awesome to get, we get that 22% bump if people start Googling for Savage Starlight because they want to know more about it. And then they find our podcast. So yeah, I'm rooting hard for it, but I don't think we got it yet. And I think they probably called that out on the official podcast or not. Naughty Dog's maintaining an Instagram where they're calling out some of these Easter eggs, like the lighter the Tess uses to immolate the infected at the end is an exact replica of what Sam Drake, Nathan's older brother, his lighter from Last of Us 4. I'm sorry, Uncharted 4. So like, yeah, I would think that would have been called out because there's a lot of Savage Starlight fans. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily the podcast. A lot of those too.
I'm quickly becoming an Ellie fan. It seems like this. And this one of these things was in the trailer where she starts making clicker type noises or infected noises. I think that's hilarious. They didn't find it very funny, but I did.
It's one of those things where I almost wish they kept it out of the trailer.
I know. But you got to show people something, right?
You got to sell. Yeah, like Bella, they'd be really throwing Bella Ramsey to the wolves if they never showed any Ellie shit in the trailer because people were already like, she doesn't look like fucking Ellie. She didn't seem like Ellie in Game of Thrones. So, like, I understand
right?
why
she's
they
an
did
actor.
It.
Come on.
Right.
No, I really like her in this scene. Just all of the sarcasm, all of the, like, her banter with Joel too, where she's like, there's not gonna be anything bad in that room, is there? And he's like, just you. I mean, they're already starting to like have this father daughter kind of bond.
They're falling into the Joel Sarah pattern we saw so effective in the opening of the series. I think Bella's crushing it. I had my, if you listen to the preview and the first episode, that was the one thing I was shaky on, but by the end of this episode, no, I think she's a great Ellie. And there's going to be, someone pointed this out on Twitter, there's a whole generation of Last of Us fans that if they ever go to play the game are going to be like, who the fuck is this?
Yeah.
Because this is going to be their definitive Ellie. And
that's interesting how that's going to work.
Yeah.
All right, they see some bombing scars in the city as they walk, and they talk about them briefly. There's a fallen building in their path, so they decide to check another route from the top of a hotel. And Ellie earns Tess's respect by telling her how she got bit and asks a little bit about the infected in the city. It's like a fucked up moon, Aaron. This whole landscape.
It's like a fucked up moon. It's a lunar landscape. She's hanging out in the QZ, in a closed mall. I think it's so like Stranger Things, right? The idea of teenagers hanging out in a mall, but then you put it in a post-apocalypse and it's in a closed mall and it's got infected and they're out there fucking around and they got bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot of, I actually think we're going to have a spore lore because there's a few things I wanted to talk about, differences between the show and the video game that I wanted to talk through with you.
Okay.
But yeah, I thought it's another great scene. I like the idea that they bombed and you've got this ferocious military response, and even then it only worked in a handful of cities. You know, Boston's one of them, where it allowed them to create a quarantine zone where remnants of the federal government are still enforcing public safety and rule and rationing shit. It feels right.
When you say worked, you mean it held
it
the
kept
infection
humanity
at bay
from going
long
extinct
enough to mount some response. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Still not enough to keep us the dominant species on the planet, but
no.
There's some good stuff here too, connecting Ellie and Tess with their kind of rule breaking attitudes and their basic sort of respect for each other's badassery, I guess. I like that.
Yeah,
and they're setting stuff up too for later in the episode. You know, Ellie's asking about like, oh, are there these type of creatures that explode and release spores? And they're like, that's stupid. And then she asks, are there some that like have split open heads and see like bats, and they say nothing, right? Because obviously we're going to encounter those later in the episode.
Yeah, and then just as she's, you know, puts that in the viewer's mind, you hear this inhuman howl coming from deep in the city, and like everyone kind of freezes, and Joel's like, we better keep moving. So like, there was this kind of like, Ellie's kind of, oh, you know, this isn't this bit bad. You hear all these things about swarms and infected, and here we're walking around, we're, you know, not a care in the world. This, another one of those, like, foreshadowing, tension building things that's put in your mind that like it's not as safe as it appears.
Yeah, and this is where the tension really begins, right? That yeah. cry you hear from the city is like, okay, put your boots on because we're about to walk into some serious shit. They reach the hotel where Ellie role plays a bit as a bellhop, and they climb up to the 10th floor, but their path is blocked. So Tess climbs through the rubble to unlock a door from the other side, leaving Joel and Ellie to face their awkwardness. Ellie asks too many questions about Joel before Tess rescues him by opening a door.
Yeah. Then this is where I think you see Tess and Joel both start to take a shine to Ellie, especially Tess. You know, she likes the fact that she's inquisitive and reads books and knows a bit about the fall, and you know, she's being this kid until she gets a little like minor scare. And again, it's all building tension, you know? This reminded me of the scene of Jaws is like when the guy's diving underwater, like looking at this wreckage, and then a head just floats out of the hole in the boat. It's just like, oh my God, you think, you know, this is subtly saying that every time you think you're safe, you're not really. And I also touched, oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
As you say, this is the closest thing, I think, to a jump scare in the entire episode.
Yeah.
Where the, you know, she accidentally like pushes, or she pushes the luggage cart out of the way, and a skeleton kind of drops out at her.
Yeah.
But it wasn't really that much of a jump scare, and it turns out to be nothing. But to me, like, the more tense part of this entire thing, and why that sort of relieves some of the tension briefly, is I don't know, maybe this is me as a Walking Dead viewer having seen way too many zombies come out of murky water like this, but I'm just thinking, this is incredibly dangerous. Why are they walking into this waist-deep water when they know there could be infected around? I don't think the infected work like that in this show.
We talked about this,
but
I
get residual
feelings, especially if you're going in as blind, it's like we talked about this on the instant talk portion of our instant reaction podcast on Sunday night. It's my understanding that like these are not zombies in the sense that they're reanimated dead. These are still living. Now when they're in their dormant phase, the mushroom might have their metabolism turn way down low, so they could go days and weeks without moving or eating or doing anything. But like they can't like live underwater for a day. They would die. And if they die, then the fungus can't do anything with them. It's not like it can just take over their dead brain. Although I saw a lot of people, I think, get the wrong impression from some of the tendril stuff that it does resurrect people.
Oh, in the flashback scene at the beginning? Yeah.
No, I'm talking about in the, like, when you see the tendrils touch the dead body, or like it seems like a dead body kind of activates, and then another tendril touches what looks like a dead body, but I think those are not dead, they're dormant.
Gotcha.
They're essentially like in a deep medical coma until the tendrils wake them up. I could be wrong, because again, the fungal science is kind of like not super exact in the games, and it's still got a lot of wiggle room here, but I think it's cool.
And when we get the skeleton dropping out and Ellie gets scared, and then Joel like extends his hand to help her up, it's a super awkward moment between them, because he gives his hand, he pulls her up, and then he just flinches, he pulls away from her like he's allergic to what is it, the intimacy or the infection that he thinks she might have? Is it both?
It could be both, but he does a similar reaction to Tess when he finds out she's infected, where he flinches away from her. So I think
but specifically this young girl who reminds him so much of his daughter.
That might be it too, that it's like a ghost, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I also think he's got I think he's like what defines Joel is that he is a survivor, and he might not even remember why he's surviving, but it's a habit and he keeps doing it, right?
Yeah.
And I think you get some ingrained like jerking away from people that might be infected. I think they're hinting at that like that's why he's a survivor. you know, like if you're not his kin or in his tribe, he could give two shits about pulling over to the side of the road and helping you or what, like, because he's going to make a home. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about the, because this happens a lot in the game too, where they artificially come up with a reason, like a collapsed floor. You got to boost someone to this level where one of the point of view characters gets left behind either by themselves or you divide a larger group into a smaller group so they can have intimate conversations. And I like mm-hmm. how they do that. And then sometimes it's just for psychological value. Like you're in a tense situation and you have this like comfort of Ellie being with you or one of the other kind of survivors you meet along the way is there with you and you're talking. And it's always like you got company, right? But then mm-hmm. suddenly they have to squeeze through a hole and you're worried about them and you're worried about yourself. And you don't, it's, I like that they're kind of doing those same mechanics and not in a way that feels like a gamey, like when these levels collapse and cut them off, like that's just game development 101. You're hurting the player to where you want them to go, but it doesn't feel like that when you're watching. It's like, oh, a floor collapse. Of course, you know, they're going to have to find a way around uh-huh. this. But you get all the same benefits. You get this beautiful conversation where these really wary Joel and Ellie are trying to like explore, like, where are you from? You know, how'd you know that? And like they keep on, you know, because they don't trust each other, they keep on stopping it. But you have this really interesting conversation where Joel talks about killing fungal people in contrast to killing the guard in Boston. And you can see him thinking about that conversation's interrupted mm-hmm. by Tess, but like his wheel spinning about how do I feel about killing that guy? You know?
Yeah, there's so much of Joel is just shut down and he keeps it that way. And I,
it's an unexamined life he's living, it seems like.
Absolutely. Yeah. To the point where he doesn't even know why he's living. And I really love when Tess, you know, comes to unlock this door and they hear her and Joel starts to raise his gun and through the door, she can't see him. She's just like, Joel, put the gun down. Mm-hmm. She knows him so well, right? Like,
yeah, I'm not going to get shot by your paranoid ass.
Yeah, that stuff is just so good. Anyway, from the rooftop bar, they see a mass of infected writhing around in the street, which is supposed to be their route to the state house. They decide to go through a museum instead to try and reach it. That's a lot of infected.
We'll see them later.
But we talked about this in the instant take a little bit and questioned, like, okay, what exactly is happening there? And you wondered if there was some kind of like photoreactive sort of quality to the infected. And I think you're right, because I watched that scene in more detail. And it is when the clouds pass overhead and there's a gap in them and the sun shines through, as soon as it hits that mass, they start rolling over. And I think it's to shield kind of, maybe the
yeah,
part.
Yeah, cringe.
Of,
they're definitely cringing away from it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it happens progressively as the sun crosses the mass. So
it's so funny because like I feel like, and this is a very minor criticism of the episode, but I feel like they were trying to tell, like, look at these people moving like a sea of grass and that means they're all connected. But to me, the obvious explanation was the photosensitivity. And when I was listening to a podcast, they mentioned they did several reshoots where like Neil and Craig, the two showrunners, are so familiar with this game that they're like, we don't have to establish that the clickers can't see, mm-hmm. you know, they'll suddenly Joel will be quiet and they'll be making that clicking thing and they have the whole head and people just understand. And one of the other executive producers was watching, just like, I don't get it. Why they don't have eyes, but like, why would I assume that they can't have to see at all? Or, you know, like, am I really looking at? And they're like, oh, we have to go back and insert. We had to do a reshoot where Pedro Pascal turns to Bella and says they can't see, they can only hear, so that no one gets left behind. And I feel like maybe this is a case where they had a clear idea what they're trying to communicate. Because like, if I'm looking at what I'm seeing, I'm not seeing people that are connected in a mushroom network. I'm seeing sun progressively pan over them. And as the sun hits them, they have a rolling reaction to that noxious stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird that they use this to make the point about them being connected in this, you know, as Craig Mazin called it, the wood wide web, which is a real thing you can Google. It's, you know, cutting edge research from like the last decade or two where, you know, we're just now realizing the fungal colonies are connected a lot and can exchange like chemical signals over vast distances in more sophisticated ways than we ever suspected before, you know, which makes them sometimes You know, they're finding out that these fungal colonies can be the largest organisms on Earth. You know, that like they could be the size of Connecticut and Rhode Island, and it's one single organism that is genetically identical and it's connected through this underground network. So it's really cool, but it's like the visuals they showed for that did not match up with what I thought Tess was explaining. You know?
Yeah, I feel you. I'm glad.
It's
that
like
they
it's
did.
Like if Tess is explaining like why you can see thunder or see lightning before you hear thunder, and they're showing a rainbow. Like, okay, that's interesting information, but what the fuck does a rainbow have to do with it? It's a small criticism, but I wonder if it's one of those things where Craig and Neil knew what the fuck they were talking about, and it just...
Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm glad that they did the reshoots for Pedro explaining, hey, they can't see, but they can hear, because Ellie needs to know, right? I mean, that's more important even than the audience knowing. Like, she needs to know. It would not make much sense if she somehow instinctively knew that they couldn't see, right? I mean, I guess...
Yeah. And you love a good audience. You love a good audience surrogate where it doesn't, you know, it's like it's always stupid when you have a team of doctors briefing themselves on something that's like, well, for review for everyone, let's talk about immunology 101. But when you have like a reporter there or a military guy, it makes sense for them to like. So like Ellie, who's been shut into quarantine zone her entire life, has very little real life experience with this. Like these grizzled vets teaching it. It's a natural. So like, yeah, use it to the hilt, you know.
Yeah, that audience proxy comes in real handy sometimes.
Yep.
So we go to the Bostonian Museum, where they go inside. The museum's covered inside and out with dried up fungus, and their goal is to get to the top floor, where there's apparently a crossing. The ceiling caves in, blocking their exit, and they encounter several clickers, only barely managing to survive. This is where I really started to notice the sets, not just like the you know, CG visual effects of like skylines and stuff, but the sets, the set dressings are amazing. All this stuff, I think in large part, I mean, look at what they do for the marketing stuff, right? They're probably using a lot of the same techniques, just dressing the sets. It looks incredible.
It's very practical. Like where practical, they're all practical. And, I like the fact that the clickers are just dudes in rubber suits.
Sure. You know?
And they mentioned on the podcast that, or no, maybe it was the making of featurette, that they hired people who were big fans of the game. That's like, you know what a clicker looks like and how they behave, and they nail it. Like,
yeah,
there's something really effective about that herky jerky, you know, idle animation they have, and where they're randomly freaking out and, you know, lashing out at this and that. It feels like, you know, Ratatouille with a neurological problem. Like you get that, like this human being is being intermittently steered by something that's just kind of like figuring things out as it goes. It's it's
and they
great.
Nail the sound. Like as someone who has played the game, they sound exactly like they do in the game.
Yeah, that's like hearing a group of clickers in a dark room is a, like with a good set of headphones or a good hi-fi system, is a bone chilling experience, because they do that 3D spatial sound really, really well.
Yeah.
And there's so much like the game, like them getting their flashlights out before they go in. Like it's very, it feels so much like the game without even trying. You find, and there's also effect of like, you know, you're an audience, you don't know how to feel about things, and you've seen how blasé Joel and Tess have been about things so far. But when they find that man ripped up, and Ellie's like, Jesus, what could have done this to a person? And you see like palpable terror coming from Tess. Where she still wants to try to talk herself into this path, but she's like, well, what if it's this? What if it's this? But like, she is freaking the fuck out, because these are things that are not to be fucked with.
Yeah. And then the way that they bring down the volume, right? They're just like,
yeah, I don't hear anything.
From,
well, what would you hear?
On silence. Like, and as he's saying the word silence, his voice is getting quieter. It's,
yes.
It's remarkably well done in those moments.
And that's where the tension.
Ellie, like when she's whispering, is too loud for Joel.
Yes.
I'm like, man, she's whispering. What do you want? And then she takes it down a notch. There's like, I don't even know how you mic that up,
right?
And how you keep, like, I don't know, an intern back at the crafts table chewing a sandwich from coming across a mic when it's that hot.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Man, they must have been in the booth for that. They must have dubbed that.
It's great. I like how, and then the things really slow down and get spooky. The tension really builds when it's quiet because you can hear every squeak and rattle in this decaying building, the dry vines they step on, which is another great concept. Mm-hmm. Like, fungus are not immortal. They have to take on new nutrients. They have to grow. And if they're deprived of that for a long enough time, they not only go dormant, they just dry out, desiccate, and die. They have a life cycle. So it's not like, you know, things that get conquered by fungus are just going to be there forever and ever and ever. This shows that there is, you know, some hope that you could reclaim these areas. But
tension ratcheting up in this scene. It's off the charts at that point when they go silent.
The way they use, are we talking about the attack or we want to, did you? Okay. Cause like what you mentioned, the set design and this like museum set was especially effective because there's all these glass cases and the clickers can't see, but we can. And the video game, there's a where Joel can go into like listening mode where you hold a button and like the sound drops out and you can kind of see rough outlines of things moving through walls that, you know, allows you to have a chance against the clickers really. But it's almost like duplicated in this because you have these solid walls that block the line of sight of sound, but you can see the clicker. The clicker can't see you. And it's just a great way to, again, ape that feel of being in the video game where it's like that thing is just on the side of the case and you're just moving around the corner before it gets to you. And even if you do everything right, sooner or later, you know, it's the thing's going to scream and come at you. And they also nailed how relatively tough these are. Like Joel puts like six rounds into that thing's chest and it barely slows it down. Tess throws a hatchet in its face and it barely slows it down. Like Joel has to eventually empty a fucking revolver into this thing's head before it stops moving. These, as the fungus takes over more and more of these victims' bodies, it takes things away, like sight and fine motor control, but it greatly increases their endurance and their strength and their speed.
I really love the detail. It just tickles me that Ellie gets bit in exactly the same spot that she got bit before. That's so funny to me, but it is.
And they also, the way that, like, you know, they're not just like in an action movie where they're just like locking and loading, like emptying full clips when they can. It shows them taking careful shots, you know, because like they don't have unlimited ammo and they're just in Boston. They're not even that far away from their home base and they've expended a lot of their supplies. You just never feel like, it's not like in Predator, not like Predator ever, but like, you know, in the early goings of Predator, it's like, what could harm these guys? You know, they're never like that. They're not properly equipped for this kind of action. So it's just, again, they really effectively build up all that tension. Tess goes away and is lost for a long time. They kind of come in and save each other a few times. I just thought it worked really, really well.
And this, you know, if this is the second time through the episode, this is the start of the 5 to 15 minute timer. This must be when Tess gets bit. And I think they hit that mark for me. Like, it's just believable enough that this would be the high end of the 15-minute timer.
Plus, I noticed they put it on...
from when she gets bit to when she turns.
It's not exactly on her neck. It's, like, on her trapezius. Like, it's kind of, like, starting from neck and shoulder. So, it's like, well, could you get...
It's as
like,
close of a torso bite as you can get to being a neck bite.
Yeah, so, like, do you get 30 or 40? So, I thought there's even some play between, like, face or neck... torso. This is it a torso? So yeah, I thought that they did a really good job. Someone also noticed that there's exactly a minute elapses from when Joel says they're about a minute away till when the infected get there, kind of showing that like Joel is really, you know, he's done this a lot. He kind of knows like
how fast
this isn't
his
first rodeo, and he's an old hand at this.
Yeah, and earlier in the episode they had set up that it was a 10-minute straight shot to the state house, 10-minute walk. So you can feel like you're really close to the state house. It's just these damn buildings keep falling down in our way.
Yes.
So once they get past that and then the bite happens, it's like, well, it might be a minute and a half walk to the state house.
Yeah. Especially since Tess is like fucking moving. She is
right. That's
like,
the other thing I love about
she's
this.
She's not ambling. She, you know, when you're watching this again, you can clearly see the change of effect.
Yeah,
she's pulling
really
Ellie along.
Well,
she's short with Joel. She doesn't have time with his for his bullshit. Because they also mentioned that, like, you know, we saw this in the first episode, that Tess is very good at managing Joel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in that that early debate they have about whether they, you know, while Ellie's off pissing in the girls' room, they're having this debate about what to do. Like, we should just go back versus, no, she's this. And they make a compelling case that Tess is already a believer. She's crossed into the light. And Joel is not. And instead of, like, with the convert, you know, with the zeal of a convert coming and be like, you know, you've got, she cajoles him and is like, look, this is the best. Okay, it's a fake. But the Fireflies believe it, and getting her to the Fireflies is the best way for us to get the battery in the truck, and we want that. So even though she's bought onto the mission, she's telling Joel, well, you see all that shit drop once she's big, because now she's on a timer, and she doesn't have time for his bullshit. And,
well, and
I'd
she knows
love seeing
she hasn't convinced him, right? He might just, if she dies, he might turn around and just take her straight back. And then there goes the hope for humanity. There goes...
Right.
Honestly, her redemption, I mean, she makes kind of that point near the end of this.
Yeah.
It's all really powerful stuff, and it's so subtle. It's almost like you don't really realize it till your second watch, that change, that switch that flips.
Yeah. I also like, you know, from a video game standpoint, seeing them, like, makeshift bandaging wounds and things, like using electrical tape and duct tape to set, like, minor sprains. Like, that's very... video gamey too, but it felt it felt good.
A lot of bandages and alcohol that you pick up in that game.
It's all you don't need health care, you just need duct tape and isopropyl alcohol.
So let's talk about that scene. They exit to the roof of the museum where Joel patches up Tess's sprained ankle, and then he appreciates the city view with Ellie. And Tess gets them moving again, and they head to the state house. You know, Joel's thinking about Ellie, and he kind of glances at his watch. Again, another fairly subtle thing. And I love the way that Pedro plays that moment. Mm-hmm. I love everything about this scene. I love Anna Torv's intensity. It's so sad that we're losing Tess this early, because that actor is so good. And I'm really starting to, like, appreciate what she's doing here, and boom, she's gone.
Yeah, and I remember thinking that when playing the video game the first time, that was a real, you know, like, oh, wow, like a Ned Stark moment. Like, damn, a loss early on is going to be one of those type of games, huh? It's really effective. And I thought she did a great job of, like you said, being kind of fierce and, you know, trying to argue for, you know, her essentially putting faith in this Ellie thing.
And this is a story told in... glances at wrists, because Joel looks at his own watch and he kind of, like, moves it a little bit. And he's, you know, thinking about his daughter. He's thinking about, man, what am I going to do about this girl who I don't want anything to do with, but I kind of need to do something about it. And then later when they're walking, he's glancing at her wrist. Like, is she turning? Is that infection getting worse? Am I going to have to deal with this? What's going on? Yeah, I really like that symmetry there.
Yeah, him, like, again, I think it's a powerful moment. He flinches. She goes to... And there's so much stuff that's, like, they say, and you kind of get, you know, their special relationship. She has this one point. It's like, I've never asked you to do this, that, and the other. But one thing, she's like, I've never asked you to feel the same things I've felt. Making it seem like maybe Tess would like to have maybe made things more official and settled down with Joel, and then he's not on to that level, and he's not capable of that kind of emotional vulnerability. But she's like, I am asking you to see this thing through. Like, she talks to Ellie's like, you know, we're pretty shitty people. You know, we've done a lot of bad things to survive. I want my death to mean something more than a chicken parmesan sandwich.
we're kind of in the final sequence here, but that's one of the things that's so affecting about it, is the way she begs him, please just do this. I know you don't have hope yet, but I do. Please, for me, for us, for the world, just do this thing, complete this mission, because she knows she can't. That's the thing. Like, when she's hustling people along to try and get to the Firefly, she's like, well, okay, I don't trust that Joel is actually going to do this, and I have to get this girl there before I die. Because if I don't, it might not happen, and I have a limited time now. And when she sees that hope is gone, it's devastating when the Fireflies are not there, when they've been killed. And now she has to just, you know, muster all of the trust and loyalty and whatever it is that her and Joel have built up in the last 20 years to get this man to do this one thing that he really does not want to do. And that he does not want to do to his core, right? I mean, it's not just about like he doesn't believe that this girl is not the hope for humanity. He can't I think he can't emotionally stand being near her is a thing. Like when I said he was allergic to her touch, it wasn't because she's infected necessarily. It's also because he is reminded every single time he looks at her of his daughter.
Conversely, if he starts thinking she does have a future, then what if he loses her, and what if he's responsible for it again? There's that blame game. And
so this is the thing he's tried to avoid feeling for 20 years, and now it's being thrown in his face so vividly.
Exactly. Like she's just open wound and constant trigger for him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we go to the ad, make every shot count. We'll be back with more of Savage Starlight.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations, while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Ah!
We're not the cure for mankind, but we have your favorite podcast. Here's more of Savage Starlight.
So let's talk about the final sequence here. They reach the state house. They find the fireflies are all dead. Tess reveals she's been bit, and she uses her last moments of humanity to convince Joel to get Ellie to Bill and Frank. Joel kills an infected, which wakes the horde, who comes running after them. Tess spills the gas and the grenades and sacrifices herself to take out the horde as Ellie and Joel escape out the back.
What should we say? I thought if I was going to criticize Tess a bit, she's a little spindy with grenades. I think she should have given half those grenades to Joel.
At least hold one. Hold on to one in case your lighter doesn't light or something.
Yeah, and then no matter what happens, that thing's going off. But yeah, you got that shitty lighter. And I don't know that it was the when I watched it the second time, I didn't think it was the lighter. She was like failing to light the lighter because the lighter was shit, or that she was incompetent. I think you're right on. You're supposed to understand that the fungus is already starting to take her over. She's losing that fine motor control, at least her conscious control over it. And simultaneously, you know, the mushroom is doing the freeze all motor functions routine on her. The same way we talk about the like those toxoplasmoids that they can make mice, you know, attracted towards things that are usually repel them. She's kind of frozen. And I was thinking, like, you know, when they talk about how mushrooms can control you through hallucinations and stuff, it's like, what does it look to be inside Tess when this thing's coming towards you? Does she see this as this hit? It seems like at some level she does. But is it like if you're on a mushroom trip and it's like, oh, my God, my nightstand is made out of laser beams? No, it's just wood. Oh, my God, it is made out of laser beams. Kind of like, I wonder if it's like that, or like just what is the physical experience? Because it does, like, the tear rolling down, her closed eyes and the tears. It seems like at some level she's aware of just how deeply fucked this is.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think she stood there because it was part of her self-sacrifice. I think, and the podcast heavily implies that the fungus is able to recognize that she's already infected to the extent that she can't really resist, and it leans into that. And again, like they said, that the fungus wants to connect with that. The fungus wants to spread. The fungus, it doesn't want to rip people apart if it doesn't need to, because that's its biomass. Mm-hmm. That's the both its vector to spread, and also its food and its substrate. All that stuff was really fascinating and just extremely gross. Just fucking gross.
Horrifying and gross. She does such a good job in that scene too, just like expressing the horror without being able to like physically react to it. And it's terrible. It's really terrible, and I love it.
It is. And also the other hallmark of I think that works really well with this post-apocalypse is, you know, you've got the Massachusetts state building. You know, America's not an old country. You know, you go over to Europe and it's easy to find a pub that's 800 years old, or God, you're in Rome and the Colosseum's 2000 plus, and, you know, go to Giza and there's stuff that's 5000 years old. But America, it's like it's hard to find stuff that's more than a couple hundred years old. Well, this is one of them. This is one of the cradles of democracy. This is one of the oldest state houses. It's one of the best regarded in terms of its architecture. It's got this distinctive gold gilded 24 karat dome that still, you know, gold doesn't rust. It's still shining bright as it's, and they blow it up just to let two people, like, all this history and beauty and still standing strong, and they blow it up to save two. It's just so unsentimental is what it is.
I guess the question you got to ask is, what would you rather have, your past or your future?
Right.
And that is what she chooses, the future, right? Whereas Joel is very much stuck in the past. So it makes a lot of sense for her to be the ones to destroy this monument. Yeah.
It's just like, when you blow a building of this historical significance, and there's just something, again, so completely, utterly unsentimental about it. It's very, that's very The Last of Us, I think.
It really makes it stand out. You know how, like, in video games, a lot of the times people won't allow, certain companies won't allow you to do like damage models to cars because they don't want to show their Mercedes Benz all fucked up or whatever.
Right.
They're like, oh, we don't want to give that image. Boston here, this is not a great look for Boston. And they uh-huh. took it in stride, no problem.
Yeah.
So Mercedes stride, maybe learn a thing or two.
Like Joel tanks the loss of his pseudo lover. Like he just tanks this round emotionally. He just stomps off with this impassive face. And you see Ellie, mm-hmm. she needs a minute. Like she was just warming up the Tess, but she had warmed up the Tess in a way. She hasn't warmed up to Joel, and now she's stuck with this. Like that scene where he grabs her and just like essentially bodily carries him out. She's like, doesn't want to leave Tess behind, and you bastard, and this, and that's such a great shot. And the music, that mournful music, and the contrast between how beautiful the setting, the golden hour is on Ellie, and how vividly green and the vivid oranges and stuff of the fungal is, how beautiful everything looks, just like the opening scene. In contrast to the violence that's just happened emotionally, physically, all those things, just God, I fucking love. And that's very true to the game too. You will see some of the most beautiful things you've ever seen. And then the next minute you will be in terror. They're crushing it. They're killing it.
I wonder if Ellie is reluctant to leave Tess because she herself is immune, and she wonders, look, I was immune. I saw this miracle happen. Why couldn't it happen to Tess? Let's stay around. Let's not sacrifice herself needlessly. She might be immune too. We don't know.
It's something I think a lot of people are thinking after last week's episode, where Fedra's official policy is everyone that's infected gets shot on sight or put to sleep.
When like, a kid gets put down immediately,
How many Ellies have we burnt in a parking lot when... because it's been 20 years. Is Ellie literally the first, or is it just a first one that hasn't gotten the official policy applied to? It's right. Food for thought. And I think that that's, you got to be thinking about that.
Mm-hmm. That's it for the episode.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed this one.
There's a couple things in the behind the episode I want to talk about. Like the fact that I think Neil said this on the podcast, but they work so hard to get the clickers right. And Mazin's got that great quote. It's like, our goal was, if you played the game, you're like, oh yeah, that's right. And if you hadn't played the game, you're just like, oh my fucking God. But they just
that's
like
in the post credits thing,
the looking, the feel, the sounds, everything nailed it. They're not CGI, they're actual performances. And a big part of that is Barry Gower. You know, remember we talked about how like you see Chernobyl and there's some scenes like the melting firemen and the decay of the post-fall Chernobyl. And it's like, oh, yeah, this team can do fucking The Last of Us. Well, this is the guy who did all those prosthetics, did all the set, the design and decoration. And it's just getting the team back together and applying it to what feels like a vertical market. It's just great. And yeah, they talk, I was talking about how to say it. I've been saying it mycelium this whole time, but apparently it's mycelium. That's the tendril-like thing that grow, that cobwebby-like stuff that you saw in Our Lady's skin, and these tendrils. That's the name of the fungal matter that they use to spread their fruiting bodies. So I thought that was really cool stuff. And then there's some stuff we want to talk in a spore lore section. I want to just wrap with Jim about some video game stuff. So this is kind of where you want to bounce out if you're not keen to know some differences between the show and a video game and some possible spoilers for the future. Tlou, TLOU at baldmove.com is how you want to send us feedback. If you haven't already and you're a fan of what we're doing here at Savage Starlight, please find our feed on your favorite podcast app. Give us a couple stars, a thumbs up, a review, whatever the interface calls for. That is a big reason that we're able to, grow like the fungus that we aspire to be.
Our mycelium.
Yeah. You are our, what do they call it? You are substrate. Also you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/baldmove. If you want to stay up with the latest and greatest releases, we got lots of podcasts going on. We're about to hit another busy season. We're going to have so much stuff coming out this late winter and spring. Yellow Jackets, Picard season 3. What's the big one I'm forgetting?
Mandalorian.
Mandalorian. Another lone wolf cub story. So follow us on twitter.com/baldmove. We will be back Thursday to consider the Tlou at baldmove.com feedback. But now it's time for the spore lore. We'll see you on Thursday. So Jim, it's been a while since I played the game, but I noticed some inconsistencies in Ellie's story. And I also noticed some kind of like fun little Easter eggs. Number one, she said that she was alone when she got bit. Unless they're changing the story, she is lying.
She's lying. You can see it
on her
face.
She's totally lying.
She's lying.
I thought so too.
Yeah. And you can see it on her face when she answers about a boyfriend as well.
That was hilarious when she's like, "Do you have a boyfriend?" No.
And then she kind of like sheepishly looks around. Looks at Tess maybe a little. Yeah.
Fans of the game will know that Ellie will eventually manifest as a young lesbian. I've never seen an older male and weird than when I say she manifests as a young. She transforms. She Pokemon evolves.
She comes,
they fed her the lesbo candy and she went that way. No, that's how they see. I find a way to make it worse until people. I'm so pathetic that people can't hate me. That's my whole strategy. It's like, look at this fucking old man with his fungus ridden brain, herky jerky on this podcast. Jesus. It's amazing he can say two words together. The other intriguing video game thing that is, it's probably got to be Easter egg, establishing Ellie can't swim because some of the dumbest parts of The Last of Us are where you are ferrying her on a pallet across different bodies of water in some kind of perverse farmer with a bag of corn and a fox and a chicken, and you got to get them across the bank without them getting ripped apart by fungal monsters. Are they going to get her on a pallet and have Pedro swim her around, or is that just for us?
I hope so as a game player, because it happens like every 40 minutes in the game. But
yeah.
It probably not. That would be so ridiculous, right?
Yeah. I think it's because like the other thing is like I always like there's no fucking way this pallet's going to float her.
Right.
This is less believable than Rose and her goddamn headboard or whatever. Like it's just not going to. There's not that much buoyancy there. The other big change. What did you think? Because like in the game, it's Fedra persecuting the group for getting out of the QZ and killing that guy. And they're like wanted. They're on the run from the official authorities. Here they slowed things down, so as soon as they got out of Boston, the QZ zone, they were pretty much scot-free, and it was all about the clickers. Any speculation why they changed that or what you think of it?
Oh, I don't know why they changed it, but I like it. I think with the change they've made to the fungus and the way it spreads, it was good payoff for that stuff. And it was pretty inconsequential that Fedra was even after them in the game. Like, this might be the last time that Fedra is a major going concern. Like, they encounter them occasionally through the game, but it never feels like they're being hunted by the authorities, right?
Yeah,
just like the authorities happen to show up here because they heard about a Firefly meeting, I guess.
This feels
a lot more natural to me.
Yeah, and I think in the game, as part of the balances, you kind of keep the player, you have to rotate the different types of enemies and or it gets every, like, you can't just you go through 6 hours of fighting clickers. You got to have, you know, the there's what do they call the raiders? You got to have the raiders, you got to have the military groups, you got to have the runners versus the clickers versus the bloaters versus the shamblers versus like you have to throw it in a TV show. It's not as important. So part of it is just like you don't want to just be all clickers all the time. So you throw in a Fedra chase just to kind of spice things up.
Sure.
You don't have to worry about this here. So just, you know, you haven't seen the clickers. People want to see the clickers. The other thing. Yeah. And so like give them the fucking clickers. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did any other big changes from video game to show that you noticed?
Not big ones. There's a lot of minor ones with like sort of mashups of like different lines and stuff. But
can I ask you why they made Ellie lie about not being alone? It seems like inconsequential.
I think it's a sore spot emotionally for her too. I think her and Riley were pretty good friends.
I wonder if it's going to be.
It's a lot like Joel. You know, he doesn't want to talk about his daughter. She doesn't want to talk about her best friend dying.
Pass. Yeah. I wonder if it's going to be an emotional litmus test when, you know, because I feel like that they'll probably have a flashback where they show this happen the way this series is going. And then we'll know, the audience, that she's lied and she's keeping this thing from Joel. And like, when she finally opens up, is that going to be like, you know, a big pivotal moment where we know she's kept something in reserve and she's sharing, and maybe Joel shares with her, and it's a corner that they turn?
I think so. That feels right.
Okay. Well, I like I said, not a huge amount of spore lore to talk about today, but I'm sure there'll be more in the feedback. And just for the grizzled video game vets,
there's one other thing.
Oh,
that you mentioned in the instant take that I didn't catch, and this time around I did. I saw it. It's that stuffed giraffe.
Oh shit! I completely forgot about that this time around. Yeah. Okay. Good. It saved it through the spore lore. Yeah, that's gotta be some foreshadowing slash Chekhov's drafting slash.
It is. I know they've cast those characters already. So, like, or well, okay. So there are two things I think this foreshadows. I think it foreshadows.
Yeah, cast the giraffes.
No, okay. I think this foreshadows like that beautiful scene where they observe the giraffes. But I think it also foreshadows
standout,
a little bit.
Standout scenes. One of the standout scenes of the game.
I think it foreshadows the Henry and Sam stuff too a little bit, right? Am I crazy and thinking maybe I'm just looking for that foreshadowing? And so like
just in
any
case
kind
of like
toy.
Okay, yeah.
Would do it.
I wonder how they'll pull that off too, because that was an interesting scene in the game where it's like you're from Joel's perspective, and if you're paying attention, you see that Ellie pulls a little fast one.
You can do it like they did with the old lady in the first episode, right? Where it's just kind of happening in the background. Because you notice in the game, you can definitely see it happen.
If you're looking in the right direction. And Yeah.
Because I was. I was like, okay, I know she picks this fucking thing up. I'm going to watch her like a hawk.
Yeah, it could be like like they did with the glass onion, Ed Norton with the glass.
Uh-huh.
It's like, unless you know that it'll be looking, you're like this misdirection. So it all tracks. But yeah, that'd be a great way to handle it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to be watching. If I see them in a toy store.
Yeah.
High alert. I'm watching you.
High alert for some five-fingered. We got the five-palm monkey looting technique and the five-fingered Ellie discount in a world with no money. That's it. That's it for the Spore Lore episode. TLou@baldmove.com. If you'd like to talk some more in-depth grizzled video game veteran stuff, we'll be back Thursday to consider that feedback. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.